From the Sky News Centre at 5, the great train robber will celebrate his 80th birthday tomorrow, a free man. Ronnie Biggs has been officially released from his prison sentence. Prison staff have left his bedside at the hospital in Norwich, where he's suffering from severe pneumonia. His son Michael spent years campaigning to get him released.
We're absolutely over the moon. I'm just now waiting. My daughter's on her way to come and see my father. We would like to thank everyone who have supported us through the years.
A pregnant British woman jailed for drug smuggling in Laos says her ordeal's been an unimaginable nightmare. 20-year-old Samantha Orabasa from South London returned to the UK earlier after being given permission to serve the rest of her prison sentence here. Six workers who've been staging a sit-in protest at a wind turbine factory have left the building. Just after midday, bailiffs broke into the Vestas on the Isle of Wight and asked the staff to leave. Ian Terry spent 18 days inside protesting at the closure of the site and the loss of hundreds of jobs.
Quite relieving, and I say I feel proud of what we've done and proud of what everyone else outside has been doing as well. I mean, I never really thought it'd take off quite as much as it has, but I mean, it's a good thing. I mean, we're glad that people have been captivated by this.
Australia have taken the lead in the fourth Ashes test with England. Live to Guy Swindles at Headingley.
Disastrous day for England. Australia 140 for 2. Already a lead of 38 after England was shot out for 102 earlier today after winning the toss and electing to bat in a match that they were hoping to win and take an unassailable lead in this Empire Ashes series. That's not going to happen. The Aussies in complete control on 140 for 2. Guy Swindles, Headingley.
The English football season kicks off tonight with the opening game of the Championship. Middlesbrough play Sheffield United in their first league match outside of the top flight in over a decade. And Edinburgh's Fringe Festival gets underway today. It includes performances from Denise Van Outen and Julian Clary. That's the latest. I'm Harriet Cost.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
You think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800... 612-0225 or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
FM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and in the studio this week, Business Development Officer for Bristol Credit Union, Tony Billington. Our regular old Labour political pundit and economics expert, Martin Summers, is here also. We'll be reviewing some of this week's news stories. Then, in the second half of the show, we'll be getting the Bristol Credit Union's take and Tony's personal take on the current financial meltdown. But before that, here's our two-week Friday drive time weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, temperatures averaging around 19 degrees Celsius, fairly sunny and, most importantly, dry. Next week, even a little bit higher, that's an average of around 20 Celsius. Cloud cover and rain will be fairly sunny week with occasional rain. Next weekend, that's the 15th and the 16th of August, averages will be lower, that's around 16 Celsius. Rainy on Saturday and cloudy on Sunday. So avoid next Saturday, that looks like rain. Okay, well, on now to our look through the week's news, and I'm joined this week by a development officer, business development officer, in fact, for Bristol Credit Union, Tony Billington. Hi, Tony.
How are you doing? Okay.
And is the credit union actually a bank? Can you just explain that to us?
No, what a credit union is a cooperative financial service which is owned by the members. We don't have any private shareholders, so any profit that we might make is returned into that community of members for their future financial betterment.
So whereabouts can people actually see the credit union and find your offices around the city?
Well, our office is at the top of Stokescroft in Cheltenham Road, pretty much opposite the Jester's Comedy venue. But we do outreach work as well, and we go around to a number of locations in Bristol, places like Withywood, Southmead, Lockleys, on a week-to-week basis.
So is that like a mobile library style thing where you kind of take the bank down and appear somewhere?
Yeah, if you like.
Sorry, I called you a bank, didn't I? Sorry.
we're a credit union.
So whereabouts do you actually do these little outreach services as well as the place at Stoke's Croft?
We go out to Withywood, Southmead, Filton Avenue, Lockleys, and one more, but I can't remember it.
Okay. So are there any other local banking type facilities? We can't call you a bank, but you know, something. Is there anything similar that that's based here in Bristol?
Not that I'm aware of. I know that Shire Hampton have their credit union. I know that First Bus have their credit union. But we're the only one that has... we have a common bond, which I'll explain in a moment. But we're the only ones which allow membership from anybody that lives, works or volunteers within the Bristol City geographical area.
So what is that common bond?
The common bond...
You're talking about the common bond between these different...
Who is allowed to join? Credit unions are sometimes established within a particular employer base. A big firm might have a small credit union. Church organisations have had credit unions before. And the way things are moving on, because credit unions are coming of age, frankly, the geographical common bond is looking to be the future of credit unions across the UK.
So explain how you're different from Barclays, Lloyds or one of the other high street banks.
Well, first of all, we have an ethical approach to what we do. I think probably the most important point is that it's member-based, it's member-owned. We're only there to serve the members, as I say, not private shareholders. It's democratically run, so every member has a vote at AGMs. Our directors, rather than receiving fat bonuses for doing diddly squat, are all volunteers. And if the membership do not like what we're doing, they can oust them.
Okay. Right, Martin Summers is here as well. Martin, by way of introduction this week, can you tell us a bit about your book, Market Failure? You wrote a book called Market Failure. Why did you write it?
It was published in 1998, and I wrote it with Dr. Laszlo Andor, of Budapest University of Economic Sciences. He's now working at the European Bank. It was about what had happened in Eastern Europe since 1989 to 1998. That decade was a very, very problematic decade. Obviously, people were happier to have the political freedom that they'd been denied previously, but a lot of the economic policy was at the time, and of course with hindsight now, clearly wrong. And what we did is we wrote the book. It took us 5 years to write it between us because we had to talk a lot about what was going to go in it, basically to get on the record what had gone wrong and why it had gone wrong from our point of view.
So do you think it has any relevance for the current economic situation?
Yes, I mean,
here
we predicted exactly this kind of crash at the end of the book. So, you know, when people say, who could have seen this coming? Well, I say, well, I did in 1998.
OK, so the book's called Market Failure, if anyone wants to look up Martin's prediction. I know you're on YouTube, Martin, aren't you, as well, predicting this about 18 months ago, a lot of what's happening today. Anyway, let's have a look now, all of us, to have a look at some of this week's stories. And let's start off with this funeral of Harry Patch. Now, this has been one of the biggest events this week. What Harry actually said was that at the end of World War One, everything was agreed around the table. So why couldn't the various leaders of the European countries have done that at the start, and millions of lives would have been saved? What are your thoughts about that, either of you?
About Patch's comment?
Yes, particularly that comment. You know, the idea that, one of the things he was particularly irritated about was that, well, they managed to settle it at the end of the war. Why couldn't they have been discussing the settlement at the beginning of the war?
Well, they didn't settle it even at the end, did they? Because the Versailles Treaty was very hostile to German national interests and led to a kind of a problem subsequently. Keynes, the British economist, his most famous early book was The Economic Consequences of the Peace, where he argued, and he was a senior British civil servant, and he was saying, look, we can't punish the Germans in this way, it won't work, they'll never pay us because these kind of reparations never get paid, and all you're going to do is antagonise them and perhaps lay the ground for another war. And of course he was proved right in all of that. They never paid, and another war came out of it. And the real problem underlying all of this is the tension between different national capitalist powers like Germany and Britain fighting for control of the world market. And, of course, the European Union ultimately came out of all of this as a means of trying to sort of, let's have a joint policy about all of this so that we're not arguing and fighting about it. But, of course, it's still not resolved, all of these things. We've still got these problems in the world economy today.
So what are your thoughts, Tony, about Harry Patch? Is it really as significant as been in the news this week, do you think?
The fact that he's now dead?
Well, yeah, the last chap who was actually lived through the First World War is now no longer with us.
I don't mean to sound like a killjoy, but, you know, there's always got to be a first of something and a last of something. Yeah? I think it's remarkable that he made it to 111th, seeing as what he'd been through. That's the most extraordinary thing I can imagine to have happened to him.
Okay, and also, Martin, one of these things that's been being discussed this week is this whole idea of the inevitability of war. And it seems that Harry was one of those people that didn't believe that it was inevitable and that saw it as something that could be really ended forever, because, of course, the First World War was sold on the idea that this is the war to end all wars.
Yes, it's very sad that when I heard of Harry Patch's death on the radio, the very next item was about a young British soldier dying in Afghanistan. And it just brings home to you that these things are still going on. We're still fighting. There's all kinds of reasons for that. One could go into all of the reasons, but it's a sad reflection that all of the sacrifices that were made in the past to try and bring about world peace do seem to have failed in some major respects.
Well, General Sir Richard Dannett, who was at his the memorial service in Wells Cathedral yesterday, did say that he thought that some wars are justified, whereas I think Harry Patch probably would say the opposite. Do you think that's a fair thing to say, that some wars are justified?
I think it's a big step from saying some wars are justified to saying this particular war, whatever it is.
Well, that maybe was the implication. Yeah. I don't know what Sir Richard Dannett was saying.
Most people, I was an aid worker in Bosnia, and I saw what was happening to the Bosnian Muslims, and if they hadn't defended themselves, they would have been massacred. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And I think everybody recognises a right of self-defence, but that's not the same thing as charging around the world, invading faraway countries, basically to try and control their politics and their resources. I mean, that is surely what's got to stop. I mean, we're actually back in Afghanistan, just like in the 19th century, back in Iraq, just like we were in the 1940s, and for pretty much the same reasons. And that's just not acceptable to my mind.
Tony, what do you think about this idea of the right of self-defence? Is that something we should take seriously?
I think that's absolutely right. I wouldn't like the idea of somebody marching into Britain and trying to impose a set of values or set of laws which don't fit with the British psyche. So I think the right to self-defence is absolutely right. But I quite agree with Martin that that doesn't mean that, because in our national interests it's very useful for us to get hold of Middle Eastern oil, so we go marching into Iraq. That's absolutely crazy.
OK, on to our next news story, and this is the new points system which the Labour government have unveiled for immigrants. This, I think, is particularly controversial in that, you know, it seems, certainly my take on this is that one would have thought that whether you get British citizenship should depend on things like simply whether you have relatives here and whether you have a just, cause to be here. Say, for example, if you're an asylum seeker, would either of you like to kick off on your thoughts on this new points system?
Well, I did spend a brief while working for the assessment by interview, which was the new government scheme where people who were applying for their first passport would be interviewed. Authentication by interview, that's right. A new scheme whereby it made it much more difficult for terrorists and people to have two passports.
To get passports and visas, right.
But the whole process was not thought out whatsoever, because from an estimate of something approaching 80 translators per week required in various different languages in London, because they thought, well, most people who don't speak English may not be planning to holiday abroad, therefore won't need a passport. This was the thinking. Lo and behold, because they can now apply for a passport, and they're told they can, they surely go ahead and do, even though they're never going to holiday anywhere else. So rather than 80 translators per week required, they find they need something approaching 8,000 just to service the people who don't speak English so well, but who are qualified as a British resident and therefore able to have a passport. So I just don't believe that this is thoroughly investigated, thoroughly researched, or thoroughly thought through.
So how would you think, someone who's had a little bit of experience of this kind of thing professionally, what would be the most sensible system? Should we just leave it as it is?
I don't know that I'm the right person to ask that question.
Martin, maybe you've got some thoughts.
I think what's got to be clear is that the system needs to be clear and transparent, and everybody knows on what basis people are allowed to stay here and what not. I think that you've got to remember that, you know, people coming to this country is actually an economic gain often. A lot of the people who are coming in are very highly skilled and are actually, in a way, depriving their previous societies of their skills. I mean, I'm thinking of sort of people like nurses in the health service and so on. But I think what's got to be clear to make for everybody's sake is it's got to be transparent and fair.
And what sort of criteria, though, do you think should enable someone to get citizenship?
Well, I mean, the criteria have got to be, as you say, things like, have they got relatives here? Are they married to a British citizen? Things of this sort. I mean, they used to have what they call patriality. If you had a grandparent who was British, you were entitled to a passport.
I mean, one of the most obvious things, it seems to me, is for asylum seekers, if they're being threatened in their own country and they make possible political threats against them, maybe facing arrest or whatever in their own country, then that's a good reason to be.
Well, that's a good reason for them to stay. I mean, under the UN Convention, Britain, as all civilised states, is obliged to shelter those people. Now, that doesn't mean that they get automatic citizenship. They get the right to shelter.
But, I mean, how do you...
But they can be naturalised citizens, and this I presume, is... What this is about is the small number of people who come from outside the EU who come as economic migrants, yeah? That's what this is about. And Britain, in fact, does very well out of cherry-picking the best brains from the rest of the world to come as economic migrants, although there has been some criticism that they go for people with high qualifications and not high skills, in terms of practical skills.
But if a foreign government is after somebody, how do we know it's a political thing?
Yeah, that's a different thing from what's going on here. I mean, yes. We can talk about that if you like, but that's not what this is about. Yeah, I mean, people have a right to protection from violence and what have you, but that's a different thing. And people mix up asylum seeking and immigration, and they're not the same thing. Asylum seekers, if they are judged to be genuine, are here because they first face persecution in their own countries. And we know lots of asylum seekers here in Bristol, and many of them would love to go back to their own countries and would go back where there's the relevant political changes. Now, some of those people may ultimately become British citizens through naturalisation. Yeah, that's what people do. If they stay for long enough, they say, well, I'm integrated in the community now, can I become a naturalised citizen? But many of them, if there were political changes in the countries they came from, would go back. But that's a completely different thing from this. This is about people coming to Britain who are, you know, basically economic migrants, and at what point are they allowed to be British citizens? And, you know, at a certain point, if they've stayed long enough and worked to build the country up, which they presumably have, then they should be allowed to be citizens. They should certainly be allowed to vote, just because they're paying taxes, in my view.
Further than that, the article that we're discussing, which is from Tony Peck in The Guardian on Tuesday, quotes a clause in the process of application for British citizenship, which says, but those who show an, quote, active disregard for UK values, which could include protesting at homecoming parades of British troops, may find their applications blocked. Well, 2 points. First of all, if people who have active disregard for UK values still want a British passport, why would they want that? And if they do want one for some reason, they'll just keep their mouths shut with their protesting and behave accordingly. And the other point that springs to mind is, well, what do you do with people who already have British citizenship, like the thousands who protested at the Iraq War or the poll tax? What do you do with them? Are you supposed to bring in some sanction against people who already live here and have the freedom of speech and all these essential ingredients which are supposed to make up the British life?
Yeah, well, can I just add to that? I mean, that's I quite agree with that. And I mean, as far as I'm concerned, protesting is part of the British way of life. And to suggest that people who protest are somehow... In another sentence, they're saying those who work for political parties should be allowed to... You know, they're going to get extra points. Now, that's a bit of a contradiction, isn't it? Because those political parties, legitimate political parties, for example, like the Liberal Democrats who oppose the war in Iraq... Would they be allowed to oppose the war? I think this is they're getting
their passports away, don't they? Exactly.
I mean, this is Big Brother stuff. Your right to citizenship should be based upon objective criteria. Yeah, depending on where you come from, whether you fulfil criteria, and it shouldn't be based on all of this kind of, you know, carrots and sticks about whether you're agreeing with government policy or not. That's very dangerous.
Okay, moving on to another international story now, and this is something that I hadn't read about in the papers in Britain or anywhere else, and it's come from an Iranian TV channel called Press TV. Apparently there's been a failed coup in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Prince Bandar bin Sultan, the kingdom's former ambassador to the United States, is reportedly under house arrest. This story was last Sunday, after a conspiracy against the monarch. So we do sometimes forget, don't we, that Martin, that we're allied with Saudi Arabia, but it's still really quite an old-fashioned monarchy.
Well, yes, and at the same time we're huffing and puffing about whether the election in Iran was democratic or not. I mean, I'm not going to make a comment about that because it's obviously up in the air. But at least they have an election. In Saudi Arabia, they have a coup. But who are we in alliance with? Ah.
Anyway, what are your thoughts on Saudi Arabia, Tony?
I'm just worried about everything that's happening in the Middle East from one end of it to the other. I mean, we do have relations with Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of opposition to the regime out there. We seem to be turning a bit of a blind eye to their human rights record. And as Martin was saying, it's a bit odd that this perhaps wasn't reported more fully.
Because
it's obviously been hushed-hush.
Yeah, I think it may have been a little bit, because it's a bit embarrassing, isn't it? I mean, also, maybe the fact is that there's a bit of a power struggle going on in Saudi Arabia between whether they are loyal to the West and the war on terror and the various wars in these Muslim nations, or whether they're more likely to be loyal to, say, somebody like China.
I know it says here that the guy who's been put under house arrest or put under arrest is known as Bandar Bush because of his close relation with former US President George W. Bush. So it could be that this is an American-backed coup in Saudi Arabia, which has failed. It could be, but I mean, obviously it's very, very opaque from this sitting in a studio
it
in
is,
Bristol.
Yeah.
I wouldn't like to make a comment, really.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, we just never know as well when you're told about a coup attempt. Unless there's a bit more information, it's very difficult to know what's really been going on the ground.
And part of the danger is that although we're discussing it quite comfortably here, it's very unlikely that anybody would be able to discuss it out there. And we do tend to preach a bit over in Britain, don't we? You know, we seem to think we have got it right. Well, we ain't.
Well, we'll be talking more about that in the second half of the programme. Okay, next story is fears rising over the side effects of Tamiflu as cases of adverse reactions double in a week. Now, apparently, a lot of people are now finding that the Tamiflu antiviral, we've been talking about this over the last few weeks, but it seems quite significant that we're having as many as, we were told by the chair of Bristol City Council's Health Committee last week it was 10%, but some people are saying as many as 50% of young people who are taking the Tamiflu are coming up with some rather nasty side effects. Tony, do you want to kick off on this one? Would you give Tamiflu to your children or take it yourself?
Probably not, is the short answer.
I mean, yes.
As a child, I had double pneumonia, and I got through that. I've had bouts of influenza since then. It's going to be rough for a week, but, well, you know, things are rough sometimes.
Martin?
Well, I mean, we discussed this last week. I mean, I think if you're basically in good health, it's probably not worth the risk. I mean, you know, people having nightmares and bad reactions, but... there's no reason for you to take it unless you're in poor health. But I think people who are in poor health, it may be that the right thing to do is to take it. I'm not a medical person, so I don't want to be dogmatic about this. I see that they're talking about having all school children vaccinated, and that strikes me as a bit of overkill, and very, very handy for the people supplying the vaccines who are going to make a fortune at public expense.
Well, yes, so Liam Donaldson, the chief... This is back to the Tamiflu, not the vaccine. So Liam Donaldson, the chief medical officer, appealed for calm after the release of the study, which showed that 53% of children who take Tamiflu suffer from nausea, nightmares and other reactions. I think that's pretty serious amount. Yeah?
Nausea? What was the other ones?
Well, we have here nausea, nightmares and other reactions.
Well, no different from a regular week.
But then you see there are also cases, apparently, of heart and eye problems, together with 46 cases of psychiatric disorders and 48 disorders of the nervous system. There's also been one unexplained death. This was reported in the Daily Mail.
But swine flu itself is killing people, not at a huge rate, but, you know, 1 in 100 or whatever is dying. So, you know, it's a very difficult judgment to make. And I think it really needs to be left in the hands of genuine professionals. But also, what worries me about all of these decisions is that they're not just professional decisions. There's pressure to vaccinate because some vested interests sell vaccines. And the whole pharmaceutical industry is about selling stuff to people. Yeah.
I was in my local pharmacy just a couple of weeks ago when Tamiflu first became available through the phone line. And people were queuing in dozens to pick up their batch of Tamiflu, not ill at all. And I have a suspicion that people who, even if they get a sniffle, are going to think, oh my God, I've got swine flu, and they'll start sticking it down their throats. It's a little bit reminds me of the early bread strikes in the 1970s, very early 70s. My dad thought, this is just a joke. Everybody was stockpiling bread in their homes. This is before freezers, incidentally. And a week later, he went along the street when the bins were out, ready to be collected, had a look through the lids, and every single bin was full of mouldy bread. No wonder there was a bread shortage.
So we might be finding bins full of Tamiflu.
Probably, 6 months' time, a year's time, when this is all blown over, everybody will look back and think, what was I panicking about? What was the worry?
I think the most serious concern, though, is that this, putting public health aside and individuals who take it, their health, is the fact that the more Tamiflu there is around, the more likely that the flu viruses are to build up a resistance against it, and then, of course, it becomes useless.
Mm.
Anyway, next story is a bit more down to earth. This is up on the Downs in Bristol, and we are here from one of our guests a few weeks ago. He's now decided that Bristol cyclists are going to get, that's John Rogers, Liberal Democrat councillor, the Bristol cyclists are going to get the ladies' mile to themselves on Sunday the 30th of August. For the first time ever, the ladies' mile, which runs from the Water Tower down towards the Blaise Castle direction, is going to be, I think, 6, 7, 8 hours or so, sealed off completely from traffic, so cyclists get it to themselves. Martin, what do you think? Are you going to be cycling up there on the Sunday the 30th of August?
Well, I'm more of a walker than a cycler, but I think having it on a Sunday implies that, that there's not, you know, that it might cause traffic problems on a working day. But on a Sunday, I can't see that it will. And let's give it a go and see how it works, you know.
I'm just chuckling away at this one. I just cracks me up. I'm thinking to myself, well, what are they going to do? Just go backwards and forwards all day?
They can have races.
And?
Well,
what's it going to... Is it part of a campaign?
Well, I think the idea is to Bristol is seen as a cycling city. It's got lots of cycle lanes. We've got the cycle path.
Lots of money for sustain in Bristol. And Bristol has been named as a kind of green city. So this is part of branding for Bristol as well. Whether it actually does anything practical, I mean. Not much, but it's symbolic, isn't it?
You know? I mean, we heard just yesterday in the city centre at the bottom of St Michael's Hill there was a nasty accident with the cyclist and a lorry, and I think the idea really here is to try and clear these menacing vehicles off the road and just allow the cyclists a little bit of free space up on the Downs. The ironic thing apparently is as well that you're not allowed to cycle on the Downs, so you have to stick to the road when you're up there on the on that particular day.
The 30th of August. Trees from the top of White Ladies Road towards Westbury on Trim along there, They could put a little sort
that
of
is it. That is the Ladies Mile.
Oh,
yeah.
That
yeah.
is the Ladies
it's
Mile.
It's a lot
right.
tree-lined place. Right. That's the bit that's going to be free.
Just inside that row of trees, they could put a little cycle track, get the bikes off the road where they'll be a lot safer, and free up the streets for cars to go up and down.
What a good idea. Now,
I think they
next year.
Joined up thinking.
But then, of course, then you see you would be accused of tarmacking over the downs.
Yeah, and all the road users, of course, will turn around and say, well, why are cyclists getting preferential treatment?
Do you think the economic crisis is going to mean we have less traffic anyway, Martin? What do you think?
Well, at some point it will.
But we won't need to close the Ladies' Mile.
In the technical terms, the elasticity of demand for car use is very high. That is to say, you know, the economic crisis would really, really have to bite before people stopped using cars because we've become so dependent upon them. Bristol, despite its aspirations to be a green, cycle-friendly city, is still a huge traffic jam on many days. And that's just part of the way we live now, I'm afraid. We've made the choices about having, you know, private cars as opposed to public mass transit a long time ago.
Yeah, but you see, in the 1960s, there was hardly any cars around. Well, far less than there are now. And surely it wouldn't take a lot to get back to that sort of situation.
Well, I mean, if an economic crisis bites sufficiently, then that's the sort of thing that will happen. Stuff I've been reading suggests, for example, that some suburbs in the US are becoming unviable precisely because of the rising gasoline prices, so that people can't afford to commute from them anymore, and therefore they're leaving them and they're becoming ghost suburbs. And that will happen as the oil price rises, of course. But in Britain, of course, we've got a lot of tax on fuel, which means that we're managing the price a bit. I mean, in the US, they're used basically to very, very cheap fuel. So they've built all of the infrastructure on the understanding that fuel's going to be cheap. And, of course, they find it very difficult to adapt when it ain't.
OK, our final story, news story of the week, is that Gordon Brown is on holiday. Has gone on holiday for a month, and so Harriet Harman's running the country. I think that's just, as far as I can ascertain, Harriet Harman will be running Britain for the first 2 weeks of Gordon's holiday, and Peter Mandelson will be running it for the second half. Martin, what are your thoughts on Harriet's job, what she's done so far this week?
Well, I don't want to be too critical since I'm a member of her party. I think she's trying to establish a kind of media profile for herself by talking about women's issues like rape and so on, which I think is welcome. I mean, we don't see many women in those kind of senior positions. But I must say that the whole leadership, the whole cabinet, and including Peter Mandelson, are not responding to the economic crisis with the serious approach that I would expect from them. They're still in love with the market. They're still not so understood what's wrong with what's gone on before. And of course, all of this stuff about women's rights could be seen as a lot of window dressing.
Well, between Harriet Harman and Peter Mandelson running the country over the next month, did you say 2 weeks each? Well, it's just an obvious example of the flexible working pattern that's really established in this country. At least they are job sharing.
Oh, okay. And the other thing is, if Mr. Mandelson is running, I mean, he's a lord, isn't he? No one's elected him. Is Lord Mandelson?
He's been co-opted, hasn't he?
Yes. So
are they allowed to do that in credit unions? Can you co-opt people from outside to be on the board?
The board members are all proposed, and the members then vote for them.
But you couldn't co-opt somebody just completely, you know, bring in Lord Mandelson to be a director or something, even though he wasn't a member of the union?
No.
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 Okay, so
do that with
I don't think our members would have it, actually.
I don't suppose Peter Mandelson would want to work for you for nothing anyway.
But it's like he's had to resign twice, and now he's kind of coming by the back door, hasn't he? I think he's an interesting figure, Mr. Mandelson. He does seem to be quite a mover and shaker behind the scenes.
Well, that's why he was on that yacht with Oleg Deripaska along with George Osborne.
Well,
I mean, I think that really says something about British politics, doesn't it? The two biggest movers and shakers in the Conservative Party and the Labour Party are at a joint party with what is effectively a Russian gangster. I mean, that's where we've got to.
Well, apparently, Mr. Mandelson is out in Corfu again this week, and he's added another minister to his portfolio whilst Gordon Brown's away. Harriet Harman's appointed somebody else to is it called the Business Department or something, whatever it is, he's Secretary of State for. And so he's managing to get build up a little power base even more whilst he's away in Corfu this week.
Well, I mean, all of this stuff is, I mean, what does actually running the country entail? I mean, you know, the civil service carries on doing what it's doing. Lots of decisions get made. It's more a question of being the titular head. It's not actually that important. But of course, the real issues are: what is the direction of the government? What's the direction of the Labour Party? Whether it wins or loses power at the next election, these things really need to be thrashed out, because at the moment there's a big vacuum where the thinking ought to be.
So you say they're titular posts, and if Gordon Brown or Harriet Harman or Peter Mandelson aren't really running things, who is?
Well, this is one of the problems, isn't it? Is that the actual fact that the political leadership doesn't actually have a handle on the real levers of power. Look at the way the bankers have, and we're going to talk about banking later, look where the bankers have just rewarded themselves huge bonuses, basically on the back of taxpayer bailouts, and the politicians are just left in the corner going humph, humph, humph. And they don't seem to have the power to do anything about that. And that's the problem, is that people watch this Punch and Judy show we call Parliament, and real decisions are being taken by the Federal Reserve in the United States of America, by the Chinese Central Bank, and the politicians really just, again, window dressing.
Well, we're talking about the whole banking crisis with Bristol Credit Union and Martin Summers after this. Floyd there with the Dark Side of the Moon track called Money. And in a minute we'll be talking again to Tony Billington from Bristol Credit Union. But first, Marina Morris is here with a report about the financial crisis and particularly bankers' bonuses. Hi, Marina.
Hello.
This week you've been looking at bankers' bonuses, particularly where the bank is effectively owned by the government.
Yes, Tony. 20 years ago, a typical maximum mortgage was a lower of 90% of property value, or 3 times salary. If property prices increased at a rate far higher than average salary growth, this restriction will gradually relax to these house buyers and indeed banks cashing in on what seems a perpetual gravy train. But in the last year or so, as the property prices fell and recent and poorest buyers ended up in negative equity, banks found themselves holding loans never likely to be fully repaid. The losses compounded and some banks went out of business, with others requiring the injection of massive governmental funding to keep them in business. Who was responsible for this? the banks for accepting undue risk for short-term returns or not appreciating or understanding the risk behind their investment toxic loans, estate agent for talking up price, the government for restricting the supplies of land for new buildings or failing to adequately regulate the banks, loan companies whose sole business was to make a sale, take a commission and pass on the risk of default. To seemingly add insult to injury, many banks, some having apparently returned to the profitability, are now paying large bonuses to its staff. What is going on? Again, going back 20 years, bank employees were mainly paid by a salary with any bonus, a small but no doubt welcome part of an employment package. However, salary growth was restricted, these bonuses becoming an ever more important part of a decent living wage for most of its staff, linking pay to the short-term financial performance of the banks. In February 2009, the Royal Banks of Scotland announced a loss in the previous year of 24.1 billion pounds, the largest annual loss in UK's corporate history. Its former chief executive, Sir Fred Godwin, having resigned from the 1st of January 2009 amidst a widespread concern over his £700,000 per year pension award. The government injected £20 billion of taxpayers' money funded by public borrowing into the company to keep it solvent. The Chancellor, Alistair Darling, announced that the government was limited bonuses paid out to staff. We want to see a cultural change. Their short-term bonuses are replaced with incentive for the long-term, he said. Mr. Darling said bonuses at RBS would be cut from the £2.5 billion paid last to £340 million. This would be no reward for people who have failed, he added. And future bonuses will no longer be paid in cash, but in shares. The new chief executive, Stephen Hester, has agreed to moderate his £9.6 million remuneration package set up in the past fortnight. Mr. Hester will delay taking part of his bonus in RBS shared until 2014, an extension of 2 years. The £3.4 million elements of the package is linked to share price targets.
Marina, that's lovely, thank you. And we'll be hearing your Vox Pops in a minute, because you've been out into Bristol City Centre to find out what Bristolians think about the bankers' bonuses. But in the meantime, we're going to have another chat to Tony Billington, who's here in the studio today, and look at some of the work that he does at Bristol Credit Union and get some of his opinions on the financial crisis. Tony, has Bristol Credit Union got what it takes to ride out the financial crisis, however stormy it gets?
Absolutely, without question. The Bristol Credit Union is it's really, really coming of age. An amalgamation of perhaps half a dozen smaller credit unions has meant that we've now got a coherent profile across the whole of Bristol City. We've recently taken over the running of the Bristol City Council's own credit union. It's a coherent, full package of ethical, local, honest financial services.
But you see, the thing is that the major banks said that we could trust them when we invested money in them.
Well, if you're worried...
Why should we trust you and not them?
Well, we're obliged to operate by the same regulations as all the other banks. We're the Financial Services Authority regulations. We have to adhere to that. And we have our own independent Act of Parliament, the Credit Union Act of 1979. We really do have to operate under a very, very tight regime. We can't just go ahead and do what we want.
Was that one of the last acts of the previous Labour government before Margaret Thatcher got in then? He said it was coming in 1979.
I was trying to check on that. I was going through Hansard trying to find out who was it did it.
I don't imagine it was the Conservative government of Margaret Thatcher.
Never
it probably
know. They just really? Occasionally will do something, you know.
Martin, do you know about that at all?
I'm afraid I don't know.
It's an interesting one. It's a bit of a quandary.
I tend to suspect, as you do, that it was one of the Labour government's legislation. But I mean, it might not have been. I mean, credit unions, in a sense, are not party political, and you know, the Conservative Party has expressed support for the credit union movement, and that's welcome, of course.
Okay, now before we go on to talk with Tony and Martin to explore this further, Marina Morris has been out onto the streets of Bristol again this week, and she's been finding out what you think about the bankers' enormous bonuses.
Should bankers get big bonuses?
No, because it's my hard-earned money that they're trying to invest, and unless they invest it wisely, they don't get a good bonus. And it doesn't depend on, because then it becomes to sales, and a bank is not, it's looking after my money, not selling my money.
No, because they've already, the taxpayers already bailed out the banks to the tune of billions at this time, and they shouldn't profit from our loss, really, to be honest with you. I feel that. I think it's morally wrong that people should profit from the people's loss. I don't think it's the level, isn't it? Because it's investment banking where they pay out most of the bonuses, isn't it? So that's encouraging people to take risks for those big bonuses. But when it's kind of... the profits that they get are theirs, you know, but the losses, of course, are ours, and that's the point, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, we don't share it. We don't share the profits. They take the profits. The profits are private. The losses are public. So why should they, again, profit from our loss? It's morally wrong, I feel.
Yes, I think they should share all their... Not necessarily... All right, they've worked hard, so they deserve a part of the bonus, but not as much as they get. And then I think their team should get a share of all the bonuses as well. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's fair that they have you know, thousands and thousands of pounds when no team has sort of helped them to get that far. So
I think if they do a good job and help the customers, then yeah, you know, but if they run the bank into the ground, then no.
Not seeing as the banks are doing so badly at the moment, no, they should have bonuses which are related to the performance of the bank. Because that's what their job was there, to make the banks do better, and if they're not performing, then they shouldn't get the bonuses.
No. Seems unfair. Seems very unfair. That's because it's them that's thinking it. They're paying themselves, aren't they? They're voting it for themselves. I can't do anything about it, but I wished I could.
Whose fault is it?
It's the banks, but the government should have done something about it. The banks should be more regulated than they are.
Greedy men.
It's between the banks and the government, actually, because the government likes it, you know, to give the private sector that freedom to do so. But then when, you know, profits are private and then losses are public, they need to look after our investment, you know, which is to billions and billions of pounds that we're bailing them out to now. So it's governmental, actually, because they actually gave them the freedom to take these huge risks with our money. Because it's essentially our money when it goes down the pan. It's not our money when it's their profit. They keep it. And that's the problem that I have with it, you know.
I think the government has got to accept responsibility for the way the economy has developed. Yes, I think the government is at fault for not taking more control a long while ago, 10 years ago.
How should the government recover its investment?
I think the government should, we pay a lot of taxes and everything, so I think the government should put their hands in their big pockets and sort it all out and start again.
Well, as any shareholder, they should be receiving dividends coming back from the banks, and also they should be controlling what the banks are doing with the money at the moment.
What needs to change?
The government.
A whole look at the system and how it's monitored and who's responsible. And the amount of risk-taking. Certain amount, but not major.
Well, I think the government needs to get greater responsibility and do more to cap what the banks are doing. The way that they seem to be getting... Banks seem to be giving astronomical bonuses to managers and people like that. Just doesn't outweigh the actual performance of the institution, the bank itself.
Well, the banks need to make their mind up. Are they the guardians of our money, or they're out to gamble on the stock exchange and do things, and I don't think they should be the same. If I could find a bank that took my money in and lent it to somebody else at a fair rate, and then I could get the equivalent rate on as my interest, I go to that bank, not one that plays the stock market, invests in other big projects all around the world. They're bankers, they're not investors.
Well, the verdict of Bristolians is that this is mostly greed then. So how have the Treasury, Martin, maybe we'll start with you, the Treasury, who are supposed to manage the economy on our behalf, failed so spectacularly this time?
Well, what tends to happen in institutions like the Treasury is groupthink. They all go to the same universities, they all study the same stuff in the same way. And
maybe they went to the same university.